is next after a summary of the news this lunchtime. With a time of 1 o'clock, here's Vaughan Savage.
Liberal Democrats have begun gathering in Birmingham for their annual conference. Nick Clegg has acknowledged it's been a tough year for the party, but said he plans to highlight their achievements in the coalition government. The Deputy Prime Minister reiterated that he would block any moves to scrap the 50 pence top rate of income tax. The Chancellor, George Osborne, has warned finance ministers meeting in Poland for a second day that time is running out to save the euro. He said European leaders must act decisively to deal with the debt problems of Greece. The Greek government has said it will press ahead with plans to impose a tough new property tax, despite fierce opposition. One of the main public service unions has planned a further 24-hour strike next month in protest at the severity of the government's austerity measures. In Libya, fighters loyal to the government are struggling to take the town of Bani Walid, which remains under the control of troops loyal to Colonel Gaddafi. The fighters tried to move into the town yesterday, but fierce resistance by Gaddafi loyalists saw them forced back. A fund has been launched to help support the families of the four men who were killed when a coal mine flooded in the Swansea Valley. The shadow Welsh Secretary and local MP Peter Hain urged members of the public to give what financial help they could after what he said was the worst mining accident Wales had seen in generations. The Northern Ireland Deputy First Minister Martin McGuinness has said he hopes his decision to stand for the Irish presidency will not be divisive and upset the victims of violence. He's expected to be formally selected as the Sinn Féin candidate tomorrow. The election takes place next month. The Environment Agency has said parts of England, including Lincolnshire, Cambridgeshire and West Norfolk, are officially classed as having drought conditions. This is due largely to rainfall in September being significantly less than usual. The weather, cool and breezy with frequent heavy and occasionally thundery showers. The BBC News and Weather at 2 minutes past one.
Vaughan, thank you very much and a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly, here to guide you through the afternoon on Radio 3 today. In an hour from now, a chance to hear the recital we broadcast live on Radio 3 on Monday from Wigmore Hall in London. Lise de La Salle plays piano music by Liszt and Chopin, Chopin's Four Ballades. That's at 2. And then an hour later, a new series offering personal views of the classics from a variety of well-known figures from the world of music. This afternoon, Gareth Malone from BBC Two's The Choir introduces music by Schubert, Verdi and Elgar. Saturday Classics is at 3. But now it's time to join Catherine Bott for this first of this weekend's early music shows, which focuses on King George III in the week of the 250th anniversary of his coronation.
Music that's instantly familiar and suffused with history, from Handel's coronation anthem, Zadok the Priest, arranged by composer George Fenton, who made such subtle and sensitive use of Handel's music in his score for the film, The Madness of King George. The choice of that particular theme is especially affecting, because in the film, it's not used in any connection with the grandeur of a state occasion. It accompanies the scene in which the poor, deluded king is being straitjacketed, apparently for his own safety. Today and tomorrow in the Early Music Show, I'm going to be doing all I can to show that there was so much more to King George III in his long reign than madness and the unfortunate loss of the American colonies. And in case you're wondering why we've opened with music composed for an earlier King George by a composer who died before our George came to the throne, well, Handel's music didn't die with him in 1759, and it was actually right up George III's slightly conservative street, so we'll be hearing more of his music over these two programmes. History has been unkind to poor George. He deserves to be remembered admiringly as a great patron of the arts. So, to redress the balance, I'm going on a virtual walk around Georgian London to find out more about his musical tastes and his influence on the artistic life of the nation. I say virtual, because instead of going out to be bombarded with all the noise pollution that renders the capital one ghastly, indistinguishable roar on the radio, I'm sitting quietly in a studio in Broadcasting House, just imagining the quaint, romantic sounds of horses, carriages, crossing sweepers, lavender cellars. How much more fun if we could take modern recording equipment into the streets of the 18th century. Hey-ho. Mind you, the London of George III can't actually have been that peaceful. There were building sites everywhere. Spanking new houses for rich men in Mayfair, bridges over the Thames. Anyway, before we set out, let's welcome the new king with Zadok the Priest in its original form.
Yeah.
written for the coronation of George II and sung at the crowning of every British monarch since, including George III's 250 years ago. Handel's Zadok the Priest, with the choir of King's College, Cambridge, and the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Sir David Wilcox. I'm imagining myself near Westminster Abbey now, and just to the south is the new Westminster Bridge, finished in 1750. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. Yes, I know Wordsworth didn't write Upon Westminster Bridge until 40 years after George III's coronation, but those lines remind us how exciting it must have been to be able to stroll so easily from North Bank to South Bank, so far upriver from London Bridge, even if Georgian ferrymen must have been getting worried about job security. George III came to the throne rather suddenly on the 25th of October 1760. His father, the Prince of Wales, had died 9 years earlier, so it was his grandfather, George II, who still occupied the throne, until he was felled by an aortic aneurysm 2 weeks before his 77th birthday. Kings must be crowned, but before George III could enjoy hearing his own performance of Zadok the Priest, there had to be a certain amount of scurrying about to find him a suitable bride. He was only 22, but he wanted to be crowned as a married man. It wasn't that he'd never been in love, but he hadn't so far fared very well. "I am born for the happiness or misery of a great nation," he wrote gloomily, "and consequently must often act contrary to my passions." In the late summer of the next year, a royal result. On the 8th of September 1761, George was married to the 17-year-old Princess Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz. The wedding day was the first time the bride and groom actually met, and they were crowned just a fortnight later. As was the usual way in those days, this wedding took place in the privacy of the Chapel Royal of St James's Palace, which had been home to George I and II, and was to be the main home of our George too. Since the wedding of his father, it had been customary for the music to royal weddings to include at least one anthem in the service. Handel had previously done the honours, but of course he was gone, so the task fell to William Boyce, master of the King's music, who was already rather busy writing pieces for the upcoming coronation, and was not best pleased. He was eventually allowed to borrow a section from his already completed coronation anthem and insert it into a wedding anthem of the same name. The coronation was, of course, held in Westminster Abbey, and here's William Boyce's anthem for it, "The King Shall Rejoice."
Thank you.
Edward Higginbottom conducting the choir of New College, Oxford, and the Academy of Ancient Music in a coronation anthem for George III by William Boyce, The King Shall Rejoice. And rejoice he did. That rushed wedding to the unknown teenage German Princess Charlotte turned into one of the happiest of all royal marriages. Unlike his grandfather, unlike his sons, George seems to have been devotedly faithful to his wife for almost 60 years. 11 months after the wedding, Charlotte bore George the first of their 15 children. And in return, George bought her the home I'm strolling past now on my virtual tour of Georgian London, Buckingham House, now grown into a palace, of course. In the 1760s, though, it was a 60-year-old townhouse, ideal as a private retreat for George's dear wife and family, and it was for a time known as the Queen's House. All their other children were born there. Marriage and fatherhood made a man of the king. His lifelong feelings of insecurity faded, and he enjoyed a number of absorbing hobbies. Like today's Prince of Wales, he was fascinated by the science of agriculture, and his model farms at Windsor earned him the nickname Farmer George. The king and queen liked music. They both played a variety of instruments and had a private band. Among the composers associated with the royal couple were Carl Friedrich Weidemann, who was the king's flute teacher, Carl Friedrich Abel, who coached the queen in chamber music. But perhaps her favourite music master was Johann Christian Bach, who'd been her teacher back in Mecklenburg. He came to London in 1762 and never went home again.
Thank you.
music by Queen Charlotte's composer of choice, J.C. Bach. His quartet in G major, Opus 19, No. 3, played by Kamerata Köln. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, and today I'm trying to wish myself and you into the London of King George III. A short, imaginary stroll through Green Park now, and I've virtually arrived at a great London institution which owes its being to King George III, Burlington House in Piccadilly, the home today of the Royal Academy of Arts. The Academy began life elsewhere in Pall Mall. Lord Burlington was still living in the house that bears his name in the mid-18th century, and only came here in 1868 via Somerset House, the Strand, and the East Wing of the National Gallery. The important thing is that the Academy was founded in 1768 by King George's personal act of generosity. But let's take a moment to recall this splendid mansion when Lord Burlington still lived here. He had a musician friend who used to give concerts in the saloon, and his name, you may be unsurprised to hear, was Handel. London Baroque with a little gavotte from Handel's Sonata in D major, HWV 397. Now this is for real. Recently I visited the present-day Royal Academy of Arts and went behind the scenes to talk to its Director of Academic Affairs, Mary-Anne Stevens. I began by asking her about the fine arts in mid-18th century London and how the Royal Academy started.
The Royal Academy of Arts began really as part of a shifting landscape in the arts generally in London in the 18th century. And it ties up with the intention amongst practitioners in the visual arts, that's painters, sculptors, architects, to professionalise themselves. The Royal Academy of Arts was not the first of such initiatives. There had already been two earlier attempts. One was the Society of Artists of Great Britain, which was founded in 1760, and then 1761 was the Free Society, and then us 7 years later. What is significant about all three organisations was that they did provide a public platform for the exhibition of works of art by contemporary artists and architects without any intervention on the part of client or patron. But in addition to that, and what set the Royal Academy aside, was that when it founded itself in 1768, its founder members really recognised the terribly important need for the professional training of the young artist. And so alongside the annual exhibition, as it was then called, now the summer exhibition, which is still in place today, we had also the establishment of the Royal Academy Schools, which is still with us today, which was very much intended to provide that professional training, that grounding, which would make the artist capable of producing great art and architecture. The importance in the story of George III is absolutely crucial. George III was approached by a group of somewhat disenchanted members of the Society of British Artists who decided to secede from the organisation in the summer, early autumn of 1768. And they approached George III to ask whether he would consider allowing them to establish their own artist organisation with his protection and support. And that is precisely what he did. He issued an instrument of foundation, and that initiated and gave the grounding for the Royal Academy of Arts.
Reading about the King, I know that he was very well educated. He was trained in all sorts of the branches of the arts to a certain degree, as he should be. It seems that really he liked collecting things perhaps more than anything else. And so maybe today we would describe him pejoratively as a dilettante. But that's a word that has rather changed its meaning. It does tend to be used in a slightly sneering way, but that wasn't the case in his lifetime, was it?
The use of the term applied to somebody, dilettante, or as a group of people, dilettanti, of which, of course, there was a society founded in 1734, was, in fact, not a pejorative term, but quite the reverse. It was an indication of taste, collecting, knowledge, and a certain standing in society as far as a connoisseurship and an appreciation of the visual arts and music and other arts. And so as a result, when a society is formed, although on the one hand it was rather for drinking and perhaps slightly lecherous activities, it was also very much dedicated to serious matters, such as the pursuit of greater and more scientific knowledge about ancient Greece and ancient Rome. The Society of Dilettanti would have encountered certainly some of the members of the Royal Academy in the early days during their grand tours in Italy, because for an artist to be properly formed in the 18th century, as indeed in the previous century, there was the need to have to visit Italy to view not only the great achievements of ancient art, the Roman heritage, but also art from the Renaissance.
Mary Ann Stevens. Now, these delightful dilettanti didn't just go on their grand tours to discover great works of art. They would also have got to know what was happening on the continental music scene. And on the whole, they liked it. In the early 18th century, the nobility became passionate supporters of Italian opera in London, which kept Handel busy for more than a decade, and rather later in the century did the same for Thomas Arne. Arne's opera Artaxerxes has been called the first English-Italian opera. Here's the aria that closes the second act, Thou Like the Glorious Sun.
Thank you.
Andrew Staples was the soloist with the classical opera company directed by Ian Page in an aria from Arne's Artaxerxes. Back to the visual arts and Marianne Stevens of the Royal Academy. I asked her, who were the founder members?
There were 34 founder members of the Royal Academy who were distributed between various classes of activity, painters, sculptors, architects and engravers. And the key personalities were, on the one hand, William Chambers, architect, who became, of course, probably best known as the architect of Somerset House as it is today, but who was also tutor to George when he was Prince of Wales, and Joshua Reynolds, who became first president of the Royal Academy, portrait painter with aspirations to being a history painter. And alongside that, and very interestingly, there was a significant group of non-British artists who were involved as founder members. So alongside Reynolds, Chambers, and of course Gainsborough, you find, on the other hand, people like Zuccarelli, Bartolozzi, Carlini, and indeed Zoffany.
One of the most wonderful things for the casual viewer like me about 18th century portraiture is the tremendously eloquent portraits of musicians, composers, and both Gainsborough and Reynolds liked to do that. Gainsborough would have been a musician if he hadn't been a painter. And they have a subject in common, Gainsborough and Reynolds, who fascinates me, Elizabeth Sheridan, born Elizabeth Linley.
Yes, what's so fascinating when you compare the way in which those two artists, Reynolds and Gainsborough, interpret that particular sitter, it speaks an enormous amount about their approach to portraiture. On the one hand, Gainsborough places Mrs. Sheridan within a landscape, which really echoes his own primary passion. If it wasn't being a musician, it was actually to be a landscape painter. Whereas Reynolds casts her in the role of St. Cecilia, which then gives one the sense that he's really trying to make a reference to the fact that he ought to be a history painter, that is, an artist engaged with making paintings about grand subject matter, which is morally uplifting as well as emotionally charged.
Marianne Stevens. Elizabeth Linley, one of the most gifted and most painted singers of her day, made a most unhappy marriage to the playwright Richard Brinsley Sheridan, who ended her career by forbidding her to sing in public, which included the houses of their friends. Joshua Reynolds was most put out one evening, saying, "What reason could they think I had for inviting them to dinner unless it was to hear her sing? For she cannot talk." Perhaps he was expecting a reward for painting her so beautifully. Here's something enchanting from her pre-marriage repertoire, though, an aria by her brother, Thomas Linley, from his cantata, Daughter of Heaven, Fair Art Thou. But Why Dost Thou Retire? By Thomas Linley the Younger, sung by Julia Gooding with the Parley of Instruments Baroque Orchestra, directed by Peter Holman. One last question for Marianne Stevens of the Royal Academy of Arts. How genuine was George III's interest in the arts and music?
I think George III's interest in the arts and music was very genuine. He not only founded the Royal Academy, gave it his personal benediction, and also promised financial support for it up until it moved to its new and permanent abode in New Somerset House in 1780. But he continued to keep a very close eye on the activities and the business of the institution, not in an overly interventionist way, although periodically he became somewhat concerned about activities within the institution, but certainly in a benign and, I think, very supportive way. Likewise, when you look at the court, one's very aware of the level of commitment to music, both with him and with his consort Charlotte, where they not only had regular concerts, they were patrons of music societies and groups, they also supported musicians, and it seems as if it was a world which was very vital and very central to both of their beings, if you like. For me, the importance for the relationship between the Royal Academy and George III is that it emerges at a period in British history in the 18th century when we have a monarch who is patently and overtly committed to cultural activities.
My thanks to Mary Ann Stevens. Well, we're lucky to have so many eloquent portraits of musicians and singers from the great painters of George III's time. Here's some music by one of Joshua Reynolds's subjects, Felice Di Giardini, concertmaster and director of the Italian Opera in London and close friend of J.C. Bach. Thank you. guitarist Andrea Dandole and ensemble Pianoforte with Sonata No. 1 by Felice Di Giardini. In tomorrow's programme, I'll be continuing the trail of George III, patron of music and the arts, with a real visit to the Royal Music Library. But let's end with a seeming glimpse into the future. In 1763, the 8-year-old Mozart performed with his sister Nannerl for King George and Queen Charlotte, and dedicated to them the works now known as K10-15. But as we listen to this little sonata, it's poignant to reflect that King George would outlive Mozart by nearly 30 years.
Thank you.
Mozart's sonata in A major, Kirchhall 12, played there in that recording by the flautist Jean-Christophe Friche, the cellist Antoine Ladrette, and the harpsichordist Olivier Beaumont. And that ends today's edition of The Early Music Show. It was presented by Catherine Bott and produced in Manchester by Sam Phillips. And as she said, Catherine will be back tomorrow to continue her exploration of King George III's impact on the arts in England. You can hear that programme at the same time, just after the 1 o'clock news tomorrow, here on Radio 3. And The Early Music Show now has its own weekly podcast, which features edited highlights from the programmes. If you'd like to hear it, all you do is go to the Radio 3 website and click on the programmes page.
On BBC Radio 3, Saturday night is Opera Night. And this weekend you can hear live opera from the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden. Join me, Donald MacLeod, for a front row seat at Puccini's celebrated but seldom seen triple bill of one-act operas, Il Trittico, with Antonio Pappano in the pit. That's Opera on 3, tonight, live at 6:20 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, in an hour from now, we have a brand new series on Radio 3, Saturday Classics. Well-known figures from the world of music give their opinions on a series of well-known pieces. The first person in the hot seat is the host of BBC Television's The Choir programme, Gareth Malone. Over the next 4 weeks, he's going to recall the pieces that helped form his youthful musical tastes. Each programme has a different theme. One of them, for instance, explores music either written for or inspired by children. Well, this afternoon's first programme features the music of two child prodigies, Chopin and Mendelssohn. You can also hear music by Schubert, Verdi and Elgar. Saturday Classics. It begins this afternoon at 3 o'clock here on Radio 3. But that's after a second chance to hear last Monday's Radio 3 live lunchtime concert, which was recorded at London's Wigmore Hall. The presenter is Fiona Talkington.
A new season of Wigmore Lunchtimes begins with an exciting young performer. The French pianist Lise de la Salle is only 23 years old, but she's already well established in the music world, having made her first live broadcast at the age of 9, and her concerto debut playing Beethoven when she was just 13. Today, here at Wigmore Hall, she plays Chopin and Liszt. Liszt's powerful and virtuosic Dante sonata to end with, and to begin in just a moment, the Four Ballades by Chopin. They were composed across a 10-year span, beginning in Chopin's early 20s. Schumann was rather taken with the first one in G minor, and in return for dedicating his Kreisleriana to Chopin, received a dedication of the second ballade in return. The poetry of the Polish writer Adam Mickiewicz is said to be an inspiration for the ballade, and the British pianist John Ogden once remarked that it's extraordinary that the last of the four is only 12 minutes long, as it contains the experiences of a lifetime. Lise de la Salle's first experiences of Chopin was her grandmother's CDs when she was a small child, but she told me earlier on that she waited a long time before playing them, before playing music which combines fragility and intensity. And here now is the pianist Lise de la Salle to begin her recital with the Four Ballades by Chopin.
Thank you. Thank you.